Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. House lawmakers pass a bill to repeal the state's death penalty. Some presidential hopefuls plan trips to New Hampshire while other potential candidates decide not to run. And what is the meaning behind the pearl necklaces worn by some male Republican lawmakers this week? These and other stories made headlines this week. We'll talk about them in this hour. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So much to talk about this week, so let's jump right in. The New Hampshire House of Representatives voted 279-88 in favor of repealing the state's death penalty. Lawmakers have done so many times before and faced gubernatorial vetoes. It's likely to face yet another veto by Republican Governor Chris Sununu. But this time, the majority vote in the House seems to be veto-proof. So, Dave Solomon, what are your thoughts on this vote?
It's certainly the best prospect the advocates for repealing the death penalty have ever seen for success in all of their efforts over the years. The chief sponsor of that effort in the House, Rennie Cushing, State Rep. Rennie Cushing, was very buoyant after the vote. The dean of death penalty repeal in the Senate, Senator John Reagan, is optimistic. The ACLU thinks it's the best chance ever. The House vote showed clearly strong enough numbers to override a veto. And in the Senate, there are 16 senators needed, and 16 senators have either voted to repeal the death penalty in the past or in their campaigns have indicated they would do so. However, I would never discount the potential impact a full-out lobbying effort by the state's law enforcement community could have. They only need to change the mind of one senator. And the prospect of them bringing out their strong community and public constituency in election season could still have considerable sway. The law enforcement community is strongly against this, and they are a force to be reckoned with in the State House, as we've seen in the past. So I don't think it's over till it's over.
Certainly not. So I spoke yesterday with former State Senator Betty Lasky. She fought for repeal for many years, and she says the political winds have shifted in part because people have heard better arguments for the repeal of the death penalty.
I do think that over the years, the objections to repeal have gotten weaker and weaker. And while everyone respects law enforcement's views on, you know, their reasons for keeping it, I don't believe the facts have proven to make that an overriding argument.
Former State Senator Betty Lasky. So as you said, Dave, It's people are taking into consideration what law enforcement community has said. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, this has been really interesting to watch. I mean, I remember back in the 90s when Gene Cheyhean vetoed a death penalty. This is part of a trend we're seeing around the country in which states, in some instances, governors are suspending the death penalty. In other instances, states are rolling it back. It's a response to the use of DNA technology to find people who are on death row who turn out to be innocent. It's a changing thoughts about how it works, as whether or not it's deterrent, and how it works, and how it's whether or not it's applied evenly across different groups of individuals. And so it seems like this is going to be a good opportunity for the death penalty to be repealed in New Hampshire. As you mentioned, there's probably be a strong push by law enforcement, by Governor Sununu, who has said he would veto it. You know, one of the questions raised by this is Michael Addison, who is the only person on New Hampshire death row convicted of in the killing of a police officer, Michael Briggs. My understanding was that this law was not supposed, repeal would not apply to him. However,
In theory, it would not, but in practice,
when we've seen this in other states where the death penalty has been repealed, people on death row are typically commuted to life without parole. Mm-hmm. So that's the question about what will happen to him.
Well, Ethan, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, so speaking of Michael Addison, so I talked to Rennie Cushing, who's been pushing for the death penalty repeal. I talked to him afterward. He said that this is not a retroactive bill. It's a forward-looking bill. So his position is that it would not affect any potential punishment for Addison should his appeals exhaust. But of course, as Dean mentioned, there have been states where this has not been the case. That might be something that you see, speaking to Dave's point, if you're trying to peel away a vote in the Senate, I think that might be something that you see in the next few months, kind of pushing on the Addison case. You know, what will this do? Could this undo that? Somebody who might be a yes vote for appeal might give them pause. So we'll have to see how that argument plays out. Just in general, in terms of this argument, I think one thing that also should be noted is that this issue is one in which lawmakers seem comfortable changing their minds and increasingly do so for various personal reasons. There was a pretty kind of stunning moment on the House floor where Representative David Welch, who is one of the longest serving representatives, he's a Republican, and has chaired the Criminal Justice Committee and has opposed the death penalty for 16 terms. It came out on the floor and said that he had changed his mind and cited the recent passing of his wife as an example of he was making the point that he kind of it underscored to him the toll that it can take for a family of someone who might be executed and might be innocent or otherwise.
Yeah.
So, and we've seen other representatives take a similar course. And I think what it speaks to is that this is not a partisan issue. And so there's not as much entrenchment on this one where people, arguments might shift, but people kind of stand their ground and dig in. This is something where people are more pliant and the reasons really kind of in both directions kind of transcend any sort of party lines.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to watch that because I'm thinking back to many years ago where death penalty support and opposition would track a lot more closely with, you know, kind of law and order conservatives versus Democrats, and you don't see that anymore. It really does cross party lines and has a very different feel politically than it did 20 or 30 years ago.
But do lawmakers from the two major parties sort of arrive at the same position for different reasons? In other words, are libertarians, for example, wary of this, not necessarily because they're worried about wrongful convictions, but worried about the government in general taking someone's life? That is, or am I off base there?
That's definitely something that they bring up. I mean, a lot of there's kind of so many shades to this debate that it pulls in different constituencies to both sides. You know, senators and representatives from Manchester, for instance, the city in which the police officer that Michael Addison killed is from, regardless of party, they tend to oppose repeal. And so you do see, you know, when you're talking about government overreach, you can see more libertarian factions, but also people who are opposed morally to, you know, state-sanctioned executions. There are so many shades that it can pull in just different ideologies and different constituencies into different camps. So that's partly why it does defy party line politics.
Well, Dave Solomon, can you walk us through sort of the timeline of what to expect? The senators have to vote. When might that happen?
Well, the Senate will now have to hold hearings on the House bill. that was passed. So there'll be, you know, that could happen in a week or two. Then a week after that, it will come to the Senate floor for a vote. So we could see a Senate vote anywhere from, 2, 3, 4 weeks from now, after which time where it's likely to pass, after which the vote will just sit there until late in the summer when the governor, when the session resumes to vote on vetoes that were made by the governor. Mm-hmm. So we'll see a vote by the Senate somewhere in the next month that will eventually be followed by a gubernatorial veto that is assured, and then the House and the Senate will be called back into session in the summer to vote on all the governor's vetoes, this one included.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and talk to Jim in Manchester. Jim, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. Just a quick question. The Catholic Church's opposition to the death penalty, and I know on their website that they are strongly against it. It's part of their lobbying campaign in Concord. I'm just wondering, has that had an effect on the decision of lawmakers?
Thank you very much, Jim. Dave Solomon.
Yeah, I will say that this question of reconciling a pro-life position with a pro-death penalty position has always been part of the debate. It's certainly been part of the debate when it's come up in past years in the New Hampshire legislature. But it was particularly pronounced element of the debate this year, I thought. Representative Welch from Kingston, who Ethan alluded to, made his very emotional speech, had a hard time retaining his composure at times, discussing the passing of his wife, the grief he experienced, and how he felt killing a capital criminal would impose that grief on the innocent family members of that criminal, and how he felt the need to reconcile his lifetime pro-life position on the abortion issue with a corresponding position on the death penalty. And we heard that from a couple of people who changed positions, and it did compel several supporters of the death penalty, prominent supporters like Jeanine Nodder of Merrimack, to basically defend their divergent positions, saying, I stand for innocent life, but believe there are still crimes so heinous that deserve the ultimate punishment.
And there were some talk of the, for instance, speaking of religion, talking of the Ten Commandments that was brought up on the floor yesterday. One representative, I can't remember his name, but was opposed to repeal, at one point spoke out and said, I pray to the same God as you do, and I believe that this is morally just, And so it did come into a play, for sure, the religious aspect.
Yeah, worth mentioning that the religious aspect is simply one of the branches of the supporters of repeal. Another one I spoke with Betty Lasky about yesterday was that some of the families of victims did not want to be complicit in some way in the murder of another human being. They characterized it as a murder. So worth mentioning that supporters of repeal came from all sides to come together on that issue. We've got a lot to talk about today, so I want to move on to yet another thing that made a lot of, I guess you could call, waves this week. One of them is that, photos of a few male lawmakers wearing strands of pearls became the subject of debate, first on social media. That was the first place I saw them. And then in reports written by journalists like you, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, I saw you wrote about this. Lawmakers on the House Committee on Criminal Justice and Public Safety, they were listening to testimony about red flag laws. So, Dave, let's talk first about the meat of the issue, which is the red flag law. What is that?
Well, the way this law has been drafted, and it's similar to laws that have been enacted in 7, 8 other states, is designed to enable family members, spouses or intimate partners of individuals who may be in a mental health or suicidal crisis to, in essence, raise a red flag in the form of a petition to the courts seeking that person be put on a list of people banned from purchasing firearms for at least a year. Subject to appeal over that 12-month period and subject to renewal at the end of that 12-month period based on any change in their mental health condition or suicidal tendencies. The idea being that in some, if not many, of the mass shootings that we've seen in this country over the years. It appears there were many warning signs that the individual who did the shooting was heading for a crisis that could have been avoided had they been precluded from, in some cases, making very routine purchases of firearms. The bill is aggressively opposed by some Second Amendment advocates who believe that there are not sufficient due process protections in the bill to prevent individuals from being unreasonably swept up in the law.
Mm-hmm.
Supporters say those can be addressed, and the ACLU and the State Trial Attorneys Association all testified at the hearing as to some changes they would recommend to strengthen the due process procedures in the bill before it's passed.
Yeah, we've got some tape of Margaret Tilton, who spoke at the hearing on Tuesday for the red flag gun bill. She shared testimony about her son, George, who used a gun to kill himself and who she said exhibited warning signs before his death.
Severe recurrent mental illness, multiple threats of violence against self, recent acquisition of a firearm. These should have been tripwires for a more robust response.
Margaret Tilton speaking at a hearing on Tuesday. So knowing that about the red flag laws, let's get to the pearls, right? The pearls that these lawmakers were wearing. Those who handed out these pearls to these lawmakers, these Republicans who were opposed to the red flag laws, were from the Women's Defense League. And the argument, I guess, from the group's leader, Kimberly Morin, was that these pearls are a common way to express opposition to legislation like this. Is that what you found, Dave, as well, in your reporting?
Well, yeah, this was going to be a highly contentious, very well-attended public hearing from the get-go. That was well-established right from the beginning. Second Amendment groups, the NRA affiliate here in New Hampshire, for instance, expressed objection to the fact that the firearms have been banned in the House of Representatives, and they weren't going to be able to be carrying when they came to the hearing. Both sides, the state firearms group, pro-Second Amendment groups, and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense and their supporters in New Hampshire, both did everything they could to mobilize their forces for this hearing. There were about 300 people in Representatives Hall. It was a very tense day-long hearing during which the chairman of the Committee of Criminal Justice had to call for decorum several times when there was applause, pretty much exclusively applause for people speaking against the bill. On three occasions, they had to be warned not to make those displays. And both sides came with their symbols. The Moms Demand Action were wearing their well-known red T-shirts with the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. And there was one portion of the room that was a huge glob of red T-shirts.
In support of the red flag laws.
In support of the red flag laws. The Women's Defense League, which is a group of women who support Second Amendment rights in the state, were handing out these pearl necklaces to anyone who wanted to wear them as a gesture of support for the Women's Defense League position on the issue. At least four committee members, male committee members, donned these pearls, one of whom said he wasn't even aware of what he was doing. He thought it was for the Mardi Gras. But three...
He said it was for Mardi Gras?
One representative, one of the... Mr. Field, an older representative, said he wasn't even aware of the meaning. Someone handed him a string of pearls and he put it on. But there were three others who openly acknowledged that they understood what they were doing, and they were wearing them as a sign of opposition to the bill.
Let me pause you just one moment there and say this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
As the hearing got underway, the founder of Moms Demand Action, Shannon Watts from Colorado, who was in town for the hearing, tweeted out a picture of these male lawmakers wearing these pearls to her 300,000 followers, and it ignited social media. I was there. I tweeted as well that the wearing of the pearls has been interpreted as an insult to the Moms Demand Action, who were there in attendance. I was able later to clarify that the pearls were being worn in opposition to the bill, but not as an insult to the women, playing off of the old cliche, clutching the pearls.
Yeah, I mean, that's I mentioned that I saw it on Twitter first is because I saw how it was framed first on Twitter. I don't know if that was the case for you, Ethan, and Dean as well. I have never personally seen pearls used in this particular way, not discounting that they may be used this way, but it wasn't my interpretation. And Moms Demand Action seems to have framed the message quite well from their point of view. They really took control of the message.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. And we have to keep in mind this is taking place in a broader national conversation on gun reform that is ramping up since the 2018 midterm election. As Democrats have taken back the U.S. House, they've made real gains in state legislatures around the country. We're seeing a renewed push for gun reform legislation that we have not seen in a while. It's interesting, Dave said about Mardi Gras. I popped open Twitter, I saw that picture, and I thought, I thought they're celebrating Mardi Gras in the house. And then I read it, and then I sort of slowly got into the story. Pearl clutching is a social media shorthand for kind of overwrought indignation. And so, I understand the Women Defense League's argument about using these as a sign of solidarity and professionalism, et cetera. But the implication from a social media perspective should not have been lost on them. And the firestorm on Twitter was quite remarkable, and it was off to the races with it.
Let's talk now to Representative Deborah Altshuler, a Democrat. She's on the line. Thank you very much for calling, Representative Altshuler. Really appreciate it. Are you there? Oh, we must have lost
you.
You are. Okay. Hi. Thanks for calling. Yes, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on this morning. I just wanted to call in and just make a slight correction. Thank you so much, Dave Solomon, for your work on Tuesday covering the hearing. I just want to clarify that the extreme risk protection orders can only be applied for up to a year. They're not for a year. So there's a lot of judicial discretion in whether somebody is deemed to be a danger to themselves and maybe they can get some help through our community mental health center and come back to the courts in, a couple of weeks or a month, or, maybe they need some long-term help and it's going to take a little bit longer. But these extreme risk protective orders can be for anywhere between 3 days to a year and a lot of flexibility in between. So I just wanted to correct that. But the point of these is to be able to get to people who are in extreme risk to themselves and others around them and are in need of critical help. So this gives them that space and it puts a pause button in front of what could be a really impulsive and tragic act.
Well, I'm sorry, Representative, we've got to go to a break in just a moment, but I do appreciate your call. Thank you very much for that. Ethan, you wanted to comment really quickly?
Oh, I was just going back to the pearls thing. Okay. I just wanted to add a little bit of context that there is evidence that the use of these pearls has gone back to 2015 by the Women's Defense League. Yeah, and they had some photos of them being used at a signing for the concealed carry law in 2017. But the origins of why the pearls are used are sort of kind of up for debate and potentially antagonistic.
And certainly meanings change as the public discourse changes, but worth mentioning on the program that there are many sides to this particular issue. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests today, as we do every Friday, about the week that was. And if you have questions or comments about it, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. You trust the journalists you hear on NHPR because you know they follow a strong code of ethics. You know that they're working in your interest. The people who use this service are the most important single source of support for this service. Your $10 a month gift fuels this award-winning station that keeps you and your neighbors across New Hampshire in the know. Become a sustaining force for NHPR. Give today at nhpr.org.
On Monday, we're learning about Eastern Coyote. They're present all over New Hampshire, and we're also learning about differing views on how to manage the population of Eastern Coyotes. That's coming up on Monday on The Exchange. But right now, we are taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And in the studio with me are Dave Solomon, reporter for the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliota, civic scholar at SNHU. So let's talk about school discrimination. Tom Sherman, a Democratic senator, sponsored a bill that would establish state-level anti-discrimination protections in public schools on the recommendation of the Governor's Advisory Council on Diversity and Inclusion. New Hampshire is currently the only state in New England without state-level anti-discrimination protections in public schools.
Sometimes just by having these protections, you get rid of half the cases because people understand that now there's going to be accountability.
So that's Democratic Senator Tom Sherman. Ethan DeWitt, if I can go to you on this, what do you hope? What do lawmakers hope will come out of this bill?
Well, this is sort of, as I mentioned, kind of it came out of the Diversity Council. There's been other bills that we've seen that have come out of that council as well, and you know, the arguments have been sort of that, you know, this is just sort of bringing New Hampshire up to speed with other states and imposing a standard that has long been lacking, and I think that's the biggest.
Dean.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is, you know, the public schools currently have federal protection against discrimination, but there is no state protection. So by extending it to the state, it would allow the New Hampshire Attorney General, it would allow a student to bring a lawsuit against a school or a school district here in New Hampshire courts rather than having to wait to get the federal law and federal courts involved. So
a swifter path to justice.
Yeah, swifter and kind of more obvious in a sense.
Okay, and so what are its chances, Dave, do you think?
I think this bill has a very good chance. It's got bipartisan support. It comes from the governor's commission, and it's pretty open-ended. And who's going to vote against prohibitions on discrimination in the public schools, especially where, given situations that came up in Dover and other communities, a lot of the racially charged incidents appear to be happening on school buses and so forth. I do think a more interesting bill regarding anti-discrimination in schools is one that passed the House yesterday after much contentious debate that would ban discrimination on the basis of sex, race, religion, all the other things that are embodied in the state's anti-discrimination law by any school that receives public funds. And this was strongly opposed by many Republicans, although it passed, because from the opponent's point of view, it was a not so well-concealed way to ensure that public funds would never go to private schools, because many private schools are selective in their admission on the basis of some criteria that would be considered discriminatory.
So that could be quite complicated
down
the road. That
will become more controversial and complicated.
Especially for private schools, you're suggesting.
For private schools,
yeah.
Especially schools that may have provisions, religious schools in particular, which have become the most popular form of private education for parents who want an alternative to the public schools, because the parochial schools are the more economical, affordable, if you will, private school option.
Mm-hmm. So what's the next step for this particular bill?
It will probably go to another committee in the House, probably be voted on again in the House, and then go to the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another thing having to do with public school staff, and that's that lawmakers are considering a bipartisan bill that would require suicide prevention education for all state public school staff and students. Ethan, why is this important to some lawmakers?
Well, there's a general consensus that the prevalence of youth suicide is something that has been for far too long kind of not addressed head on by different schools, and that teachers and educators, while well-meaning and you know, many may have good techniques, there isn't a sort of universal way to train them. So there are two separate efforts going on. One of them is the Jason Flatt Act, which was previewed by Governor Sununu in his his budget address, and that bill would kind of require 2 hours of training for all staff of school, not just administrators, teachers, but also bus drivers and anybody who kind of comes in contact with students. There's another bill that would provide kind of deeper, kind of more comprehensive training every 3 years, and that would be at the cost of about $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are two kind of proposals, both with the same aim, and they've both kind of brought out a lot of really tragic cases of parents of children who have taken their lives have testified about how, you know, if the warning signs had been heard, and if their child had kind of had the support that they needed in the schools, sometimes the child was faced stigma, which made the problem worse. You know, there was one hearing in which a mother whose son survived an attempted suicide was, you know, kind of discovered, she said, in the act of it, and was taken out in handcuffs, basically arrested. And, you know, so there's all kinds of varying ways that schools respond to this, and the idea is to have some sort of uniformity.
Okay.
Moving forward.
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. If you've got a question or comment about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, especially if you have a thought or two about the 2020 primary, because we've seen some movement among many candidates this week, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who's making plans to come to New Hampshire on Sunday. He's going to be in Concord and also in Keene. Dean, you've written in the past that Sanders seems to favor big rallies as opposed to person-to-person events. Seems like Bernie is gearing up for at least the one in Concord is supposed to be big. I don't have any of the details on the one in Keene, but...
Yeah, that was certainly my experience in watching him in 2016. Is that he prefers these large rallies. He's not a big retail politics kind of guy. I mean, he does do smaller events, but he's not somebody you typically see kind of walking around Main Street, popping into diners and coffee shops. That's just not his thing. He much prefers to, you know, get up there and he does quite well in front of a large audience. And this is one of the interesting things that analysts are kind of grappling with. You look at who won in 2016, Donald Trump. Trump really only did rallies, did virtually no retail politics. I think once I saw him do a retail event in the Red Hour Diner in Manchester, and it looked really awkward and uncomfortable, him sitting at a booth. So, you know, he had big rallies, and he'd fly in, do a rally, fly out. Sanders liked to do big rallies, and they both won. So we'll see.
So is that the new New Hampshire strategy, just do a big rally?
I don't know. I will certainly say a number of the other candidates, certainly on the Democratic side, have really embraced retail politics, full tilt, house parties, coffee shops, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's still a desire for that, and I think it's a good thing for voters, but neither Trump nor Sanders, for them, it has never been a big focus. We'll see. Maybe he'll change this time around, but I'm not surprised to see him coming in and doing rallies.
Ethan?
Yeah, as Dean said, it kind of does speak to the changing reality of the New Hampshire primary, and it fits into the broader kind of narrative of where the New Hampshire primary, you know, first in the nation status might be heading, especially with large states like California getting some of those early votes in. But just from a historical perspective, New Hampshire has always kind of been the primary for the kind of scrappier candidates who are looking for an early edge. Back in, you know, when the primary first started, I was just reading this recently. You know, most candidates didn't actually participate in primaries. It was only done when you didn't really have enough support at the to, you know, easily win at the convention. So you needed to show that you could win elections. So it was seen as kind of for lower tiered candidates. You know, most wouldn't even enter in the primaries back in kind of the early 20th century. And, you know, I think that I don't know if that's where we're sort of heading, or, you know, but it is sort of emblematic Trump and Bernie sweep the primaries without really doing any retail politicking and without kind of shaking any hands.
Yeah, but if you look closely at Trump's kind of style of interacting with people, Sanders' style of interacting with people, I don't sense that this is a big tactical or strategic decision where they sat down with their campaigns and said, rallies or retail? I just think they both have a natural comfort level with doing rallies, and they both are fundamentally uncomfortable in these retail situations. So that's why I'm withholding judgment, because I think what we saw with them in 2016 and this focus on rallies, that's a function of their personalities and how they campaign. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a decision by them strategically to do that. We've seen plenty of other people who are much more comfortable than about Cory Booker, you know, and Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris. There have been a number of people who've been here, and they've gone from event to event, coffee shop to business. So I think it's a function of Sanders and Trump, not so much a tactical change. Sure. Maybe we'll see that in a few more primaries, but right now we really only have them as an example, and I'm hesitant to
generalize. But moving from the campaigns themselves, look at the electorate, I think it is telling, whether the candidates want to or not, it's telling that the electorate seems to be kind of pushing aside retail politicians, at least in 2016, and kind of in the primaries, overwhelmingly going for the candidates.
Yeah, well, for that one election, and so we've got to wait and see if this becomes like a trend.
And so that'll be the key.
Well, if nothing else, they both demonstrated in 2016 that the old saw that a New Hampshire voter in the primary won't vote for you unless he's met you six times doesn't apply anymore.
Maybe seen you from a distance at a rally six times. Speaking of appearances, let's talk about Pete Buttigieg, Mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's here in New Hampshire today, his second visit since announcing his exploratory committee. So thoughts on Pete Buttigieg, Dean?
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. He gets a lot of positive feedback on his appearances. He was somebody a little while ago who, you know, was in the running for being the head of the DNC. Has had presidential ambitions for a while, popular mayor of in Indiana, South Bend, I think. He's young. He's his late 30s, I think. We'll see. It depends on sort of how much time he spends on the ground here. But he certainly someone has gotten good reviews in terms of his ability to talk with voters.
Yeah. Let me ask you about another name we haven't mentioned on this program, and that's Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado. He's arriving today, and he's considering running. Dean, what's his story?
Yeah, he's not someone that people will probably be familiar with. He's a U.S. senator. He is someone who's, I think, considered a little bit more kind of moderate. Colorado Governor Hickenlooper is also running for president.
Running.
He's kind of a pragmatist. So it kind of represents a little bit of a different feel from a typical progressive candidate. But we'll see. He's someone who said he's thinking about it. I don't know that he's going to get in, but he's certainly a name that has popped up occasionally.
Okay. And it had, I think, kind of his one high-profile moment in the last few months was during the budget shutdown. He had kind of a standoff with Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Mm-hmm. And
got quite emotional, which you don't typically see from him.
Right, and it was sort of it was sort of like a movie speech.
Like a breakout moment.
Yeah, where you kind of get emotional on the floor and use, like, you know, gesticulate in it. And, remain to be seen how much he can kind of leverage that moment and others to make a name.
I will say the one other sort of primary news that got a lot of attention this week was Sherrod Brown from Ohio not running, which I think surprised people. He had been here. He is someone that there was certainly interest in him within the Democratic Party, and he's decided to stay in the Senate, as has Jeff Merkley from Oregon, another senator who spent a lot of time here early on. He's not getting in either. And Michael Bloomberg. So several people who say they're not getting in.
And Michael Bloomberg gave as a reason that he doesn't think his personal sort of more centric but leftist views don't quite align with where primary voters are right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty, from a political perspective, he was very, very effective running for mayor in New York City, pretty good at reading the political tea leaves. He feels like he's a little bit out of step ideologically for where the core of the Democratic Party is right now. As either he said or someone else said, billionaires are not particularly popular within the Democratic Party right now, given all the fervor to tax the high end of the income scale. So I think he just felt like he can do more focusing, I think, on gun rights and on climate change with his resources.
Ethan?
There doesn't seem to be kind of a huge rush to the moderate center among candidates who are declaring. I mean, you have Amy Klobuchar, but, there haven't been too many candidates. Sherrod Brown would have been, in the similar mold. He came to Concord a few weeks ago, and he came to Gibson's bookstore, and it was a packed room. Mm-hmm. Plenty of people were certainly interested in him. And then a lot of the questions were on, what is your position on the Green New Deal? What is your position on Medicare for All? And those are two proposals that are coming from the left wing of the party that he didn't support. And so I'm not sure what went into his decision.
And Bloomberg's not shy in letting people know he doesn't agree with them.
Right.
He was pretty sharp on some of those issues.
I think we're going to see Joe Biden get in the race.
Joe Biden will declare soon, you think?
95%, according to people close to him. And I think he will come in with no reservation about occupying the middle lane. And he will probably dominate that middle lane at least early on. It'll be interesting to see what effect that has on this conversation, whether it will suppress this conversation about this tension because he will gain such a pretty good traction, or whether his failure to gain traction will reinforce the message of the leftward tilt.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And here are some of the stories we've been following at NHPR this week. The state Senate voted 22-2 to tighten rules for political committees that cover the expenses of governor's inaugurations. The push for new standards comes after Governor Sununu's inaugural committee paid out thousands to his family and a top political advisor. NHPR's Josh Rogers has that story at nhpr.org. Also, the New Hampshire Senate passed two measures yesterday relating to animal cruelty. One bill seeks to fast-track cases through the court system so that animals aren't held as evidence for lengthy periods. The second bill would tighten regulations on who has to register as a pet vendor. And an effort to raise the age to buy tobacco products across New Hampshire will not move forward this year. Some lawmakers wanted to raise the minimum age to 21. Instead, lawmakers are going to take time to study the impacts of this legislation, and some plan to reintroduce it next year. Also worth mentioning this week that WMUR reported that a Republican-backed political action committee is targeting New Hampshire State Senator Democrat Dan Feltes. The ads are asking citizens to contact Feltes to tell him to stop what they're calling his push to socialism. The super PAC is called A Better New Hampshire. So can I ask you, Ethan, why you think the Republicans are targeting Dan Feltes in particular?
Well, the obvious elephant in the room is that there's a lot of speculation that he may be mounting of a gubernatorial run in 2020. It's certainly something that Republicans in the state have, kind of leapt to. This isn't the first. There's now this PAC, but the actual Republican State Party, I think about a month ago, came out with an attack-style ad against, New Hampshire Senate Democrats, but Dan Feltes kind of in particular is all over the ad. And that was over the paid family leave plan, which they kind of, characterized as an income tax. And there was all this dramatic music. I mean, it was like a, kind of late season.
It was a well-produced ad.
Sure. It was a late season, election season ad, but it happened to be, in January of 2019. Uh-huh. And again, Dan Feltes' face was all over it. So I think that, whether or not he does decide he wants to run for it, there's certainly a conventional wisdom that's growing both on the left and the right that he would be one of the primary contenders, mm-hmm. and that, the GOP is kind of doing what it can to get ahead of that and try to define his term as Senate Majority Leader before he can.
Dean.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big issues that's getting a lot of attention right now is Feltes is co-sponsoring a bill to ease Medicaid work requirements. We just expanded Medicaid here in the state. We just had a year ago an agreement between Republicans and Democrats over the nature of work requirements, and now Feltes and other Democrats are trying to roll those back down from 100 hours to 80 hours and to limit the age from 19 to 49. And, they say it's in response to some of the problems they're seeing in other states like Arkansas, who are already implementing this and having some issues. But Republicans and feel like they're kind of going back on an initial agreement. And I encourage listeners to check out. Laura did an exchange show pretty recently with Jeb Bradley and Dan Feltes, and you could kind of hear the displeasure among the two men about the way this is playing out. That Democrats feel like it needs to be revised. Republicans feel like they're going back on a deal. And so there's been a lot of criticism of him, but certainly the gubernatorial aspect of it as well.
Well, listeners, if you're looking for a past episode of The Exchange, you can always check out our website, nhpr.org. Just look for The Exchange tab under Programs, and you can find the show that Dean just referenced. You can also podcast The Exchange wherever you get your podcasts, and you can always catch up with The Exchange there. Super convenient. Right now, we're talking about the week's news on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. When we come up, we'll talk more about Governor Sununu, some of the bills he plans to veto. We'll talk a little bit about Town Meeting Day coming up next week. And, of course, a possum on Possum Drive. Why not? This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, reporter Dave Solomon for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. There's still time. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Steve in Nottingham. Steve, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for this program. Easy question. I love the fact that we do what they call retail politics and we're the primary state. And every so often And I hear rumblings that people in other states are either jealous or feel we are not really like a real America. And so they want to make us not the primary state. Now, I've loved the fact we're primary state because I actually met many of the candidates, including Obama when he ran. So the point being, is it, are we in jeopardy, that status for this 2020?
Thank you very much for the call, Steve. So maybe I'll ask you, Dean. So is the 2020 primary first-in-the-nation status in New Hampshire in jeopardy?
I don't think so. I think we're seeing a pretty healthy interest in candidates coming up here to do retail politics. Certainly on the Democratic side, we'll see what President Trump does and whether or not there's any kind of primary challenge for him. Certainly we have actually former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld is saying he's going to challenge Trump. So we'll see if that plays up here as well at all. Now, you know, I mean, the process that Steve was describing is what we call front loading, in which other states are moving up on New Hampshire in hopes of kind of getting part of the political action and all the other benefits that go along with a high visibility electoral contest. I think the we'll continue in our role, I think, for as long as this is how we select presidents. It would have to be some major shift or major change, I think, for New Hampshire to lose its role. It is threatened periodically, but we've had good success as a state in pushing back those threats from either other states or from individuals in the national parties. You know, the biggest difference for me is that, you know, when I started doing this up here about 25 years ago, it kind of ramped up a little more slowly. You could actually see some of these candidates. There'd be a little bit of national media, but not the kind of instantaneous action you see now. And that's a function of digital media, social media. You know, we see now, for example, Kamala Harris getting into the race and coming here immediately, and there's a big scene in terms of people and media, et cetera. You might not have seen that 25 years ago. She might have showed up a few times with slightly less activity, and that's a function of technology, changes in spending. But no, I think for now, I think, you know, we seem to be gearing up to play our traditional role, even if it's a little more nationalized in terms of how people experience it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the past 3 weeks, who's shown up, you wouldn't know that there's any threat to the 2020 primary.
Yeah,
it feels like
vigorous,
the last legs of a 2020 primary. Yeah. There's been just block, you know, event after event. And speaking of Harris, I mean, California's been one state that has been looked at as potential threat. As I've mentioned kind of earlier, the early voting threat, they've moved up their ability to vote earlier. And so the idea is maybe that'll draw candidates who want to get more delegates that way and want to court those votes more than New Hampshire. But you haven't seen that so far from any of the major leaders, including Harris, who has done, who she's gone to kind of out of her way to at rallies now to assure people of what she calls the elephant in the room, that the idea that she wouldn't campaign here more than you know, other candidates because she's from California. She's gone out of her way to say, no, I will campaign here, and she has appeared. And,
yeah,
other
and whenever you have a large primary field, we always talk about how different candidates may focus on different early states, and maybe Kamala Harris would focus more on South Carolina, and somebody else would focus more on Iowa. But in the end, everybody ends up, so far anyway, people continue to show up here, candidates in large numbers, and I don't think that's going to change for 2020.
Yeah.
So that's what secures the spot for New Hampshire, is that the candidates continue to believe it.
Yeah. Okay. If more, again, went to California, then maybe in 2024, there might be a shift.
It's too expensive for them.
Right.
It's a campaign in California.
Exactly. So that would have to happen, and it hasn't happened yet.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for your question. Really appreciate it. A few more things to discuss about the news of the week, and that's that Governor Chris Sununu says he expects to veto many bills this year. Without pointing to many specific pieces of legislation, Sununu said some ideas being pushed by Democrats in the State House are, quote, wacky, and that he would work to stop them. Speaking before the Manchester Chamber of Commerce, Sununu mentioned the Democratic plan for paid family leave, which relies on payroll deductions. That bill's already passed the Senate and cleared a House committee this week. Sununu says it amounts to an income tax, which he has repeatedly promised to veto.
You got to say no sometimes. And I'll be a little harsh. You got to shut stupid at the door, right? You do. When really dumb ideas are out there, you got to just hammer it down and say, what are you talking about? Absolutely. Don't waste my time.
Governor Sununu says, don't waste my time with bills that he considers stupid, what he said.
Well, it's going to be a very busy veto session for that. That's for sure. Well, there's going to be red ink all over the legislation passed by the House and Senate Democratic majorities. We can see from the legislative debate so far that there are consensus emerging around some key issues like funding for DCYF, mental health, opioid abuse, and so forth. But there is no consensus whatsoever on paid family medical leave, on the tax policies that the Republicans implemented during their period in the majority that the Democrats are trying to reverse, on election law changes that the Republicans have passed that the Democrats are trying to reverse. So we're definitely going to see gubernatorial vetoes on the death penalty, on family leave, on tax policy changes that eliminate business tax cuts that had been previously passed, on election law changes that eliminate some of the voter verification measures passed by Republicans. These Democratic bills will be vetoed, and I doubt that they will have the numbers to override, except perhaps on death penalty and maybe a few others. Probably one of the most frustrating vetoes all around will center around the expanded Medicaid program and this work requirement, which has so antagonized Republicans. Mm-hmm. They felt they had a bargain. Look, the Republicans can say, we didn't want to expand Medicaid. We viewed it as an enlargement of government. Most Republican legislatures in the state didn't. We agreed to do it because you Democrats said you'd go along with the work requirement. Now you have Medicaid expansion, 50,000 more people. Now you have a majority, and now you're trying to neutralize the work requirement. I think it's going to be very unfortunate if what happens here is the Democratic majorities pass their watered-down work requirement, Sununu vetoes it, you end up with the status quo and a huge loss of congeniality in the legislature.
Well, can I ask, maybe I'll ask Dean about this congeniality question, because the governor didn't say, I understand your precision, I respect you, and I disagree with it. He said, this is stupid. I don't want to deal with this.
I mean, that's kind of playing to the base of your party, and that's the nature of political discourse. It can get pretty rough. Those are what you would call fighting words.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's going to be protective of anything that he views as undercutting his conception of what the tax base should be like in the state. Anything dealing with business tax cuts, anything dealing with additional fees, or anything that can be argued as with the family medical leave, he can argue that this is some sort of the payroll taxes and income tax. I think that's going to be a big focus. And things where there's a lot of passion, like the rollback of the voter requirements. I think that's going to be something as well.
It's entirely possible the Democrat majority will hand him a budget that he can't sign, and we will have a budget crisis at the end of the session. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, I want to touch on one bill that might have some bipartisan support this time around. 4 years ago, lawmakers were asked to consider making the red-tailed hawk the official state raptor. And that effort then, both then and now, actually, was led by students who were trying to learn more about the legislative process. And listeners may remember how 4 years ago, lawmakers derailed this bit of legislation. And former Representative Warren Groen drew the ire of commentators nationwide by saying this.
That grasps them with its talons and then uses its razor-sharp beak to rip its victim to shreds and to basically tear it apart limb by limb. And I guess the shame about making this a state bird is it would serve as a much better mascot for Planned Parenthood.
Little context, lawmakers had been discussing abortion legislation that day. That said, this still drew, you know, a lot of commentary. John Oliver, of course, was joking about it on TV as well. And now those students are coming back. One of them, Andrew Kreiner, was in fourth grade during that push. He's in eighth grade now at Lincoln Ackerman School in Hampton Falls. And he's making the argument once more for the red-tailed hawk as the state raptor.
In fourth grade, we brought up this bill because we wanted to kind of be involved. And then as we started researching more and more, we thought that the red-tailed hawk has so many great qualities and traits about it. You know, it's adaptable. Both parents take part in incubation, feeding, raising of the young, and there are just so many great qualities of the red-tailed hawk that should be represented as a New Hampshire state symbol.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. So, Ethan, let me ask you, have lawmakers sort of changed their tune on the red-tailed hawk?
Well, that remains to be seen. what I'll say, though, is that not all of them have. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, quickly skyrocketed into something that I wasn't, you know, a reporter at the time, but I know about it. I mean, well, people of any generation kind of know about New Hampshire state politics. They saw the John Oliver clip. This is just something that one of those things that New Hampshire got known for. So the question is, given that and given that debate last time, what's going to happen this time? These bills are usually pretty perfunctory. They're pushed for by fourth graders, and they usually sail through on that day. There were questions over whether there needed to be another designation. But what I'll say is that at least one representative who spoke on the floor back then said that she's still opposing this bill. That would be Concord Democrat Christy Bartlett, who says that she's still standing against it on principle. She says that there are too many designations. She said, you know, years ago there were 31 state symbols. Now there are 39. New Hampshire already has a state bird, doesn't need a state raptor. And she says that the school should have folk. They kind of went for low hanging fruit. She put it to me, where you know they should have gone to maybe cleared out plastics or something, instead of naming a bird. So she's at least going to be opposed. We'll see how the rest of it shakes out.
Okay, well, we'll stay on this story for sure. I want to ask about this story in the Union Leader this week. Jason Schreiber wrote about a young man in Chester, New Hampshire, who went outside to grill some burgers, and he found that there was an opossum in his grill. He turned the grill off before he actually burned the opossum, which was good for the opossum, and it was taken out of there. But I guess the interesting fact here is that lo and behold, he lived on Opossum Drive. Ha ha ha.
Yes. Great animal story by Chase. I mean,
hard to make
an opossum in a grill probably would be, if I may use the animal metaphor, a dog bites man, or any other animal issue on Opossum Drive would probably be dog bites man. But an opossum stuck in a grill on Opossum Drive qualifies as man bites dog and got a lot of traction and was a pretty clever anchor for the bottom of a very strong front page that day.
Great. Well, any big town meeting day plans, gentlemen, next week? It's Tuesday.
Well, we're looking forward to a Sunday edition full of town meeting preview, which is going to be very important in about 20 or more communities that are going to decide on Keno. And if enough more, we need a lot more communities to come on board, because the number currently offering Keno are not raising enough money to cover the kindergarten promise that was made.
And okay. I'll be watching anxiously for the snow.
For the snow, yes, because 2 years in a row, right? We get a lot of it. So who knows what's going to happen on Tuesday? Dean, what do you think?
I'll be reading their reporting and focusing more on the burgeoning Democratic presidential primary.
Great. Well, thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate it. Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Special help this week from Rachel Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.